This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today marks the 12th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, and people across the country are remembering the events of that day. The Reverend Lou Ann Fry was a teacher in New Jersey on September 11, 2001. She was also a hospital chaplain who went to Ground Zero immediately after the attacks to help with the recovery effort. Now she lives in Cary, and she joins us by phone. Welcome, Reverend Fry. Good to talk with you.
Good to talk with you. Good afternoon.
I know this it must still be difficult for you to talk about, but can you give us a picture of what you were doing when you went to Ground Zero?
When I went, my role was, of course, as you mentioned, a chaplain. My role at the beginning was to be down in the pit area where the where all the damage was, and to assist the police and firefighters with recovery. And if anything was recovered, to see that a generic prayer or something was said and then brought to the morgue, and to make sure that everything was done with dignity. And then afterwards, we would go back to wherever the area we were working at and kind of download and talk about, you know, how our feelings were, what we felt, and so on. I had also been asked to do triage, psychological triage, because many of the men and women, both police and firefighters, lost friends or in search of friends and family. And some of them were there and wouldn't go home. And at a certain stages, you know, their abilities to cope with what was going on was at a psychologically dangerous level. And my job was to go and say to their superior, this person needs to be taken out of this area and see that they get some kind of treatment, even if it's a day, an hour, or what. But they need to see someone, and then when they feel they were able to come back, they would allow them to come back to the area.
Obviously, you had been trained as a minister. I assume there's some grief counseling in that. Had you received much in the way of training in grief counseling?
Yes. I took 3 units of what they call clinical pastoral education. That's one of the reasons I had been gone down there, because I had been, you know, taking those. I had taken 3 units, which is most ministers have to take at least one. My intention at one point was to become a supervisor at a hospital and make that my ministry, hospital ministry.
So you were prepared for this in some ways, and you had probably done some grief counseling. How was this particular event for you and this kind of counseling different, or was it?
It was extremely different because of the fact of the intensity of where we were, what had happened, and the amount of depth that we faced each day as we went in, you know, knowing the numbers of people who were lost.
I'm wondering, for you as a minister, did it ever feel to you overwhelming, the chore, the job of just trying to bring people or hold people together in that circumstance? Did you feel overwhelmed?
At times, yes, especially my first day there. When I got down there, they had another chaplain go down with me to the site, introducing me to the responsibilities and everything that I was expected to do. And when I looked up and looked at the site, I went, oh, how could anyone hate so much and to do such damage and so on? And it just the whole scene. I thought I was prepared because of what you see on TV. But even though the sites you see at TV really are cleansed somewhat, so the reality of the immensity of the whole situation hit me. And when I did come home that day, I just ran to our first floor bathroom and just stripped my clothes and showered and showered and showered, trying to get myself clean from what I had seen and what I had been through. And it wasn't until the next day that I could really process it and begin to be back to who I was.
I wonder how that processing has changed over time. Now, 12 years later, how has it changed for you?
Well, over the past 12 years, I've, you know, accepted certain things that have happened, and this is the reality of what happened, and reality, sadly to say, of what our world is getting to be. And it becomes frustrating at times also that people still are out there to harm others instead of learning to get along with others. And it's an ongoing thing, because sometimes you remember certain things of what you did while you were there, and then there's other times when you actually laugh about some of the things you did. And I know that sounds funny, but there were times when we would sit down there afterwards and just play jokes on each other, just to break the intensity of what we were doing.
I wonder how this is different, too, in the sense that you've obviously had to cope with grief in your personal life. You've worked with members of your congregation and helped work them through it. Now, this is a very public event as well, and once a year at least, the nation pauses to recognize the grief of all of the people and a whole nation that suffered because of this attack. How does that change things for you to see this kind of replayed once a year on television screens across the country?
Some years it's more difficult than others for some reason. But you know, when you have this, when you're facing death and the different stages of death, you know, there's a point of denial and acceptance and so on. And sometimes it hits home a little too much. And then sometimes, like today, I was just watching something, which is not my norm to do. And I did, and I was perfectly fine.
So normally, throughout the years, you've chosen not to watch these sort of...
I have watched some, yes, but not totally will go for every little show on it. You know, there's been many movies and different things like that, and most of the time, it's my avoidance, and I'll be very blunt about it.
You have friends down here who also were in New York at the time. And
yes, I live in a community where there are several police and firemen who are also down there. And we have a camaraderie because of our experiences that no one else has. Because even though you've seen it and so on, you were not there. So you really don't know. And sometimes people say, oh yeah, I know. And they don't really know unless you were there.
It's interesting, that difference. Here it is, this public spectacle and a public grief. We all feel that we've suffered, and yet, as you say, the only people who were there at the time have a very special bond that maybe the rest of us would never understand.
I think so. I mean, yes, they do. The people who have seen it and so on do have a grief. Each of us has a different type of grief. But you can't say to someone, I know how you feel. Because each of us feels grief in a different way. And each of the men and women who live down here now also feel grief in a different way because of our experiences.
Reverend Fry, I want to thank you for your service and thank you for being on the program with us.
Thank you.
Reverend Luann Fry worked in the recovery effort at Ground Zero after the 9/11 attacks. She now lives in Cary. For people like Reverend Fry, mourning over 9/11 is an intensely personal experience. At the same time, the nation experiences a collective grief as we remember the events of that day. Howard Winokur is a Charlotte-based grief counselor. He's also an educator and past president of the Association for Death Education and Counseling, and joins us now from the studios of WFAE in Charlotte. Welcome, Howard. Good to have you here.
Good afternoon, Frank. It's good to be here.
Tell us how the grief of an individual, is it processed differently if I have suffered a personal loss that is also shared with the nation? Is there any difference in how you approach a person like that in terms of counseling?
Well, let me start off. I want to respond to something Reverend Fry said. She talked about denial and stages of grief, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to know that in our field, people who work in the field of grief and death, we have not used the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross model for over 35 years. And I think people get stuck in that. And even if you were to ask Elizabeth, she never really created that model for grief. Those were actually stages of death for people who were dying. So I think we need to be really careful about this whole concept of denial and anger and acceptance. Obviously, those are parts of grief, but that model is just not a model that we need to keep using. And I think as an educator, one of the things that I try to get across to people is that that's not a model we tend to use. In my most recent book on principles and practices of grief counseling. Now, it was interesting. Reverend Fry said she had 3 clinical hours. I mean, it's very frustrating for me as someone in this field to hear how people call themselves grief counselors. I mean, what makes someone a grief counselor? How much training do they have to have? You'd mentioned that I had previously been the president of the Association for Death Education and Counseling, which is the leading, actually, organization in the world dealing with this field. And we have set up a certification where people who pass this certification, we know at least have a foundation in the body of knowledge to really work with this. The other thing that I thought was interesting, you asked the question, she took 3 clinical hours, was she prepared? I'll be honest with you, Frank, I don't think anybody could have been prepared for what people saw and what people experienced. And I think we have to be really careful. I think on one hand, there's a real validation for remembering what happened. But on the other hand, we have to be really careful because what's happening on another level is that we're also re-traumatizing people. We're bringing all these memories, these visions right back into their consciousness.
Well, and of course, you have to remember that Reverend Fry, like so many other people in her position, a minister with training and with religious training and some counseling as well, they go into a situation with the best of intentions, doing the
Absolutely.
Best they can under these extraordinary circumstances and come and through and have had an experience that is indeed their unique and subjective experience of this. But then as we get into this question of, you know, how do we counsel, you talked about re-traumatizing, and we do replay this particular event every year, and there have been countless movies. Is that therapeutic? Why do we do that? And what's the impact on the individuals who suffered a personal loss, not a national loss, but a personal loss?
Well, I think that when we show people this in terms of re-traumatizing them, it literally puts them back into the day of 9/11, 12 years ago. And it brings back all of the horror and the difficulty they had, what they saw, what they felt, what they smelled. I mean, people are affected on such very intense levels. And I think that there was a comment one time. I actually use this on my website. It says, a joy shared is doubled, a grief shared is halved. Now, I want to talk about, you had talked about mourning, and one of the things that was interesting to me when I was working on my doctoral degree. When you write a dissertation, there's a section that is sort of a explanation of how you use language, a definition of terms, it's called. And I always use the two terms, grief and mourning, synonymously. But I think this is an important distinction for people to understand, and this helps answer the question that we're talking about right now, Frank. Grief is the intrapersonal experience, all the feelings, the emotions that either each of us as an individual or even we as a culture experience. Mourning is the interpersonal experience of being able to share the grief, those feelings with someone. Everybody grieves, but I think the healing really comes from helping provide an opportunity for people to mourn. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I just wanted to, and forgive me for interrupting, but does this replay every year help in the mourning process? In other words, does it tell the individuals who had a personal loss, we're with you, we're shouldering some of this, we want to take some of the burden away from you?
Well, yes and no. Yes, I think it validates that this is something we really support you in. No, if the person doesn't have someone they can process it with. They really need people, and that's what I think Reverend Fry was talking about regarding sending some of the policemen and the firemen and the emergency workers home because they were so caught in the losses. See, it's not just the loss of death that affected us so greatly. It was the loss of security. I mean, if you think about this historically, other than maybe the Revolutionary War, most wars are fought that we've been involved in other places. And we as America for the first time realized how really vulnerable we could be. So people were dealing with losses on a multiple level. And being able to have people who can listen to them and guide them. You know, there's a difference in terms of talking to a friend and talking with someone like Reverend Fry or myself, a professional. Friends can listen but really don't have the expertise to help guide them. What we need to be able to do is provide opportunities for people to have someone who they can talk with that can help guide them through this process of their pain and their grief.
Well, you know, and on that point that most of our wars and most of the destruction is caused on other people's soil and we don't feel it, and even now the amount of damage we do abroad really stays out of the headlines and out of our sight. Do Americans, is there a different culture around grieving and mourning in this country than perhaps other cultures?
Well, it's interesting. I think generally speaking, when anyone has someone that they care about who dies, it doesn't matter what the culture is. Some of the rituals around how they may deal with the death differ significantly. But I think the feelings that people have is pretty universal, Frank. If you love somebody and they die, you're going to feel sad. You're going to feel hurt. You may feel angry. It all depends on the nature of the death.
I wonder, in a culture like ours where our expectations, and, you know, Americans so famously forward-looking, looking to the future, not looking to the past and their ancestors, if there's a way that the expectations in this country are different and we don't honor grief in the same way. We don't want to pay as much attention to grief because it's something that feels like a weakness or not as optimistic as we would like to think we are as Americans. Anything to that?
Frank, I am so glad you brought that up. That is such a critical question and an important topic. One of the things I really liked about something Elizabeth Kubler-Ross said, she said we live in a death-denying society. We don't experience death. I mean, if you think about it, 150 years ago in every American community, death was part of the community. But if you think about it now, the majority of deaths take place in typically one of three places: nursing homes, some sort of retirement homes, or hospitals. It's not part of our everyday life, although, interestingly enough, if people watch a lot of television, they're seeing thousands of deaths per year. But we don't deal very well with death, and so we tend to avoid it. We don't want to talk about it. Kubler-Ross said something interesting. She said, you can't go over death, you can't go under death, or grief, excuse me, you can't go over grief, you can't go under grief, and you can't go around grief. The only way to deal with it is to go through it. And we as Americans living in this death-denying society don't do a very good job of it. I mean, even if you think about in our hospitals, we have done such amazing work with medical technology. So people who would have died previously tend to live longer. Even children who would have died in birth with neonatal intensive care and pediatric intensive care, we keep people alive much longer than they would have lived many, many years ago. So we're not really comfortable. This is why what we're doing today is so exciting, Frank, the fact that we're even talking about it. Dealing with this whole issue of grief and death has been relatively new historically, although, interestingly enough, the first article that was ever written about this was written in 1917 by none other than Dr. Sigmund Freud, who wrote an article called Mourning and Melancholia. And the first research that was ever really done in grief was done in 1945 when they did some research on what was known as the Coconut Grove Fire in Boston, where 200, 250 people died in a fire. But what we're talking about is brand new in terms of we as a society even being willing to address these issues in a non-closeted way. It's not, you know, it's not a social conversation. Although it was interesting, I remember a couple of my students one time, we were at a play, or they were at a play, and I happened to be there, and they were talking about burial during the intermission. Now, that just doesn't happen very much. But hopefully, as we're learning more and understanding that grief is not only about death, Frank, grief is about loss. Grief is about, it could be going through a separation and divorce. It could be about dealing with getting older. It could be dealing with moving from one place to another. Well, it doesn't matter what the loss is. If you were to look at an equation, would look like, yes?
I want to thank you very much. I'm afraid we're out of time. We're not going to get to the equal sign, but I appreciate the light that you've shed on this conversation. Howard Winokur, Charlotte-based grief counselor, thanks for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Frank.
Coming up next, a new art exhibit marks the 25th anniversary of the Stone Center at UNC. Stay with us.